Yeah, we're on track probably to do somewhere between 45 and 50 million revenue. That'll equate to something around 650 to 700 deals.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Real Estate Investing Fast Track. I'm your host, Greg Helbeck. And on this podcast, you are going to learn exactly how to be a successful real estate investor step by step by me interviewing some of the top real estate investors and entrepreneurs in the entire country. And there's also going to be a bunch of episodes where I'm just going to individually talk about real estate deals that I've done that have been successful, some deals that haven't been successful. I'm going to talk about my weekly real estate investing lessons, stuff that I've learned from the trenches that you can learn for free on this podcast. So if you're looking to level up your game as a real estate investor or become a real estate investor, this is the podcast to listen to. So if you do get value from the show today, please do me a favor and leave us a review on whatever podcast platform you are listening on so we can get this message in front of more people. And without further ado, welcome to the show. Welcome to the show, my friend. I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Awesome. So we'll just get right into it. So before we talk about the giant operation that you've built in San Diego, how on earth did you even get into real estate?
Yeah, funny story. I fell into it, as many people have. I was in school, actually, and we were at a late night event. A buddy of mine, he's like, hey, do you want to take an interview tomorrow at 8 a.m.? It's like already midnight. He's friends with a professor from one of my classes. He's starting, I guess it's called a hard money business. He's looking for some sales guys. So I went to the interview the next morning at 8 a.m., not knowing anything about it. And that's why I fell into it on the investment side, doing hard money loans. So that's where it started. I learned the investor game, fix and flip, from the lending side. And then about a year and a half into it, partnered up with my now business partner, Phil. He was one of my clients right when they first started, and we built it from there.
That's awesome. So you started with hard money and then you eventually got into the actual fixing and flipping and active business operation side. The hard money business, I always tell every lender I borrow money from, I am in the wrong seat. I should be a hard money lender because those guys, they make good money and they have way less BS they have to deal with on a daily basis.
Yeah. The money space is a great business. You can also attract large pools of capital because you can deploy it. You're dealing with operators that are mostly professionals. So your client base is good, but you are selling a commoditized product. So it's a little hard to stand out. I think if you have a really strong brand, you run a real good service, it goes a long way, but then you're also always rate shop. So it's an interesting business.
So started out there, you eventually partnered up with Phil, who's also been on the show, and you built the biggest business by a landslide in San Diego and all of Southern California, in my opinion. Let's just get a picture. What does your business, GG Homes, look like today, just from a high level perspective?
Yeah, sure. Our core business, GG Homes, consider an acquisition engine, right? We are putting a lot of deals in a contract. Once they're in a contract, we're deciding if we're going to flip them, if we're going to develop them and do infill development, if we're going to wholesale them, if we're going to just close escrow and wholetail them, if we're going to list property. The core business is an acquisition engine. From there, it's also spawned off into six other businesses. So we're big in the vendor space as well, direct mail, PPC. We run a property management company really to manage our assets. So we're building these other businesses underneath it. The core business is
the acquisition. So do you mind sharing the volume you guys do? Because it's insane. And I think this will set the tone for the interview because people are going to hear this and be like, what?
Yeah, we're on track probably to do somewhere between 45 and 50 million revenue. That'll equate to something around 650 to 700 deals, largely in San Diego.
So all the listeners, you should rewind what he just said, because not only is that revenue amazing, but the volumes there and the market, which we'll talk about later, San Diego is a relatively hard market for a lot of people for many reasons, which we'll get into, but obviously you guys found a way to make it work. So my first question on the acquisition engine is you have a lot of deals coming in the door on a daily basis at this point. How do you guys make a decision on what you're going to do for the exit strategy? Because a lot of people that you and I know, mutual friends, they're just wholesalers or they're just rehabbers, or they're just buying properties to rent out. But you guys have all these different exits you do. So how do you make a decision as a company to really put that property in a position to have it be the best for the company?
Yeah, great question. Starting off, most people that are running an organization, you're going to be that decision maker yourself. Over time, what we've done is created what's called an asset management department. And these are people that we've trained up to evaluate homes, but then also on the back end, make decisions. What's our highest and best use here? And what they're factoring in is what's our return? And also what's our cash outlay going to be on a specific deal? What's our risk? What's the potential upside if a deal... there's no inventory in a specific market. Maybe we should take a shot on this property here in this zip code because there's nothing else for sale. And so we're factoring in a multitude of different data points to figure out our best course of action. And so we're balancing cash, we're balancing expected profit, balancing risk, and then looking at cash conversion, trying to keep everything running. We like to stay away from projects that we think are limited upside with high risk. Let's say it's a seller in possession. They're going to be there for 90 days. We've increased your risk a lot because it might be 90 days, might be 120 where they're out. And then on top of that, you don't know where the market's going to go. There might be additional holding costs. And if the deal is not that great to begin with, that might be one that you try to find a different strategy for. It's different factors that we'll layer on and then move it to that decision tree. And what we've done is tried to replicate a lot of what our decision making would be with an internal department. So we have 5 people that work in asset management on our team that are making these types of decisions. They're evaluating properties on the front end, but then also making decisions on the back end. And what's so interesting is, especially at scale, every little decision could be 10 grand here, 20 grand here, 100 K here. We just looked at a property this morning as an example, and this happens almost daily. We listed a house and I was looking, I was like, I think we probably listed too low. It's really well designed and my phone's blown up, which is usually a good sign that maybe we underpriced something. So it's those types of decisions compounded over a large sample size make a tremendous difference on your bottom line.
Especially at scale, because the key is you guys have so much volume that you have to make these decisions on. You have that whole internal department making those decisions, replicating you, Phil, and his brother's original thought process. So when it comes to doing like assignments, doing wholesales, I'll give you an example. In our business, we wholesale a lot of houses, mainly because I look at the deal and I say, okay, I can wholesale this out and get paid within 2 months and I can make $50,000, or I can buy this house, take the project 6 months long by the time I buy, fix, and sell and make maybe $80,000. So a lot of my decision to wholesale inventory is because I can generally make less money up front, but in terms of the cash conversion cycle and the profit, it ends up making more sense from my cash flow standpoint.
And it makes a lot of sense. Let's say that you have capital constraints, which all businesses do. 50 grand today, if you can redeploy a marketing at a 5x return and recycle that money 3 times, that same money would be done on that one flip. So for example, let's say you're on a wholesale versus flip, but if you can turn that money 3 times or 2 times, you're making 50 versus 80, plus you take the risk off of your plate. Exactly. And so it's actually better, instead of investing your money into the project, you're investing it into more marketing and operations. And so at different parts of the business, even in a scaling business, you want to be taking those versus a little bit higher amount. And so that's where that decision-making comes in. When we can wholesale a deal and make 80% of what we think, we're probably going to take a wholesale, right? Especially depending on the risk. It's those times where there's upside. You're like, oh, gosh, I think the comps are telling me this, but I just know that this market's hot. Maybe we do end up making this extra 100 G's on top of it. Yep. Those are the ones where you probably decide to invest those dollars instead of marketing and operations and growth. You invest it back into that specific project, you probably get a better return.
Exactly. Especially like you just mentioned, where there's a tight inventory neighborhood and those houses are going to fly. It's generally going to work out in your favor for the most part. But the wholesaling I've found is if the seller is a difficult person and I know that it's going to be hard to do some sort of wholesale, we'll just buy it, obviously, because you know what, let's just go close it, deal with it afterwards. But I tell a lot of people, if you're doing like somewhat volume and you can wholesale a lot of your deals and make a pretty good spread, that's going to help you grow your business quicker than trying to maximize every project. And then you're in the rehab business and you're dealing with contractors and there's a lot of risk and all that stuff. So that's a great answer. Now, the thing that caught my attention, you guys scaled this up really big in a relatively short period of time. This hasn't been 20 years. This has been what, 5, 6, 7 years. What was that journey like on that phased approach to scale? Because obviously you started out making decisions as a group, and now you have a whole team making decisions on your behalf at scale. So if you're giving someone advice on scaling their real estate business, because this is a tricky business, how did you guys do that in a phased approach organically to, in a sense, where you didn't go from like 10 deals a month to 50 deals a month? How did you guys do that in a strategic way to where it made sense?
Yeah, I think a precursor to this, just if you're an operator and you're deciding, let's say you're listening to this podcast, you're like, oh yeah, I want to scale. Make sure that's what you want. We'll get into how we did it. But truth of the matter is, sometimes you look back on the business, you're like, wow, if we just ran lean and mean, maybe it'd be better for lifestyle, maybe better for net profit. And I think a lot of operators realize that over time. For us, we realized that going bigger was more interesting, more fun, and more complex of a game. And the upsides can be larger if you can run it, and it has been. But first, number one, decide, do a pro-con list, then really think through it, because it is a lot of different challenges at each stage.
Yeah.
Now, when I started, to give you some context, we were in an office in Mission Valley. It's actually been condemned, but I remember coming to the office, and I started off working on a couch next to another sales guy. There was 5 or 6 of us. And then the office was stacked from floor to ceiling. So you'd have to shimmy to your office. That's where we started. And it was Wild West. What we had that was unique was we had a lot of really talented people that could sell, people that could innovate, and people were motivated and hungry. We wanted to figure this thing out. So we were in this constant thirst for knowledge in the very beginning stages. And there's actually parts of our business that do feel like a Wild West still. But that's how it starts out. When starting out, there's this kind of element that I think a lot of people fall into when hiring people. It's like, who will at least come work with us? We're not proven. We're not exactly sure what we're doing. We can't pay the most competitive salaries and bonus packages. We're not fully thought thought out yet. Who's going to take a risk on us? So it starts off typically with people that people know and maybe a few outside hires. And that's what happened. And what you'll realize pretty quickly is not all these people that got you to X point of your scale will get you to the place that you're looking to get. And so in the beginning stages, there was a lot of people that were great people, but maybe we're not the people we needed in those specific seats to grow.
Because you guys are at a point now where you have a true enterprise. Like you're hiring enterprise level talent and paying them enterprise money because you guys have gotten to that point. But in the beginning, like you said, you got to take what you can get to start.
That's exactly right. So we start off heavy with salespeople. And I think what you want to do is learn why is it that maybe someone can do really well in your culture, your organization, your system? And then maybe why is it not a fit for other people? Because as individuals in the workplace, everyone's extremely talented. It's just a matter of, are they in the right seat? And you'll realize quickly that sometimes you just don't have people in the right seats. And as we continue to build our systems that got us from 5 to 10 people worked up until about 20 to 25 people. But then you realize pretty quickly they were starting to break. As you scale, you'll start bringing more people in, revenue starts coming in, you start doing more deals. And then you realize that your systems have not caught up with the amount of personnel that you've now added. And so then you'll go through this process of breaking down all your existing systems, all the Google Sheets that you were utilizing. And then you build the next level of technology behind it. It's usually a little bit of frustration. And then you learn along the way. So I'd say getting good at hiring, very important. Knowing that your systems will probably break at some point, being able to rebuild them, knowing that the DNA of who you're looking for the next role might be different than what you've had previously. And then just being willing to fail forward and learn as fast as you possibly can. I think the reason we were able to get to the size in that time period is we just went for it faster and quicker and took more risk and just did it and pushed things forward faster than maybe other groups that we've seen have done it.
Absolutely. And the takeaway I'm getting from this is every time that system would break because of the growth, you found a way to resolve that to then improve it, optimize it. Kind of like in Ray Dalio's book, That Principles. Yeah. I'm sure you've read that, where he talks about that whole evolution, right?
That's one of our favorite, if not.
It's like the best book ever written. No, it makes sense. Like people, they'll see what you're doing and they'll be like, how the hell do you do that? But if you really think about every time that system would break, they would fix the system and then they'd get to the next level. And then you just keep improving that. And next thing you're doing 600-700 deals a year. And then you look back 5 years and you're like, wow, look how far we've come. And the key you said is great people, right? Because the people that you hired originally are not going to be the same people that you're going to have if you want to get to a $50 million revenue situation. Because at that point, that business goes from a small business to a large business. And in their case, the biggest business in San Diego from a flipping standpoint. So that actually brings my next topic up here. When it comes to San Diego, I've done business there. I've probably done, I don't know, 12 deals there. I lived there for 5 years. I always found from my experience, it's way harder, but the spreads are way bigger. So you're getting rewarded for the difficulty if you know what you're doing. If you don't know what you're doing, you're going to waste your money there because it's just so hard. How do you guys stay relevant in San Diego? Because you're doing the scale in a hard market. A lot of people that I know that have scaled their businesses are in the Midwest or they're in somewhere not like San Diego where the price point's over $1 million.
Yeah, it is a very difficult market. We look at where the most competitive markets are and usually have a very high cost per lead.
Yes.
You have a ton of competition, both agents and investors. We really good access to capital in those markets. You have some other large players in those markets. These are all things that when you take a look at a market from an outside perspective, how competitive is it? San Diego is probably a top three in the nation, if not maybe the top one.
I would agree with you, dude. I think San Diego is the hardest market. There's so many investors and realtors at the same time, and it's expensive.
The key, though, is getting extremely good at sales. Mm-hmm. That's where I would first land it. And there's other components behind it, which I'll talk about in a second. But if you're not very talented selling, it's going to be very hard to compete in a market like this. And when I say good at selling, there are absolute killers in the San Diego market. If you know how to communicate effectively, negotiate well, have an incredible follow-up, and have a good system behind it, that's when you can reap the rewards of these higher spreads. And you need to have some coin behind you to do it. Our average cost per contract is much higher. It's probably 3x or 5x what it is in most all other markets. We spend 16 to 20 grand to acquire a contract. And that's with good sales. And so if you don't have good sales or great sales, you're going to run yourself out of that market very quickly. You just won't be profitable. And so that's where I'd say it starts with. And if you're a solo operator or you are the salesperson in your organization, which is very common for a lot of the groups that are coming up in the game, you'll need to figure out, how do I replicate myself and get someone that's 90% as good as I am or even 80% as good as I am to eventually remove me from this role? And until you have that ability to, number one, close at a high level yourself and then replicate it it's going to be hard to scale up business in a competitive market. Now, scaling in less competitive markets, way easier. You might be the only game in town that's buying. That's mailing or running digital marketing or on television. In our market, we have 6 people on television right now. So it's not for the faint of heart. In other markets, you might be the only game in town. And there, you still need to be great at sales, but it might not be the same level. That's why virtually people can be successful wholesaling, is because they don't have a ton of competition on the ground. There's not people that have gone through 20,000 hours of sitting in living room selling, right?
You just hit it on the head, dude. That's where you just win in San Diego. If you can go belly to belly with all that knowledge and all that good ad spend behind it and all that experience collectively, it's very hard to beat a deal.
And then to elaborate a little bit further, you need to understand your market very well too, especially in a non-homogenous market. San Diego is non-homogenous. There's obviously cookie cutter neighborhoods and there's certain zip codes that sell the whole way through the same, but most zip codes are not like that. Even if you go down to the zip code, you go down to the actual community, then you look, the floor plans are different and it'll be a totally different price. The price per foot doesn't make exactly the same sense. You have canyon lots, you have ocean view lots, you have homes that are in different school districts. You have all the different components. You have infill development, you have homes you can't really develop much on. You have everything here. And so if you also understand the valuation side of a business, of a market like this, you need that to compete and give you some competitive advantages. And so I'd say that would be one of the other components behind sales. And then you have extremely good marketing as well, having large budgets to be able to do so.
That's a big thing in San Diego. It's like most people don't have the money to get in the door. And then when they get in the door, they don't have a good process to stay and get the deal. And that's why they lose versus, like you said earlier, 16 to 20K cost per acquisition. That's reality at scale in San Diego. And Eric is the best operator in town. So if you think you're going to scale in San Diego and you're going to get better results than that, you're thinking wrong. And you got to know that and not look at that as a bad thing or a good thing. Just take that for what it is and understand that's the economics of a market like San Diego or LA or New York, where our cost per acquisition isn't that high. But at the end of the day, you got to know what you're getting into before you begin that type of journey. And one more thing I want to mention that we'll transition to marketing is a big thing I noticed about San Diego is the non-homogenous situation. Because an example, if someone's local to San Diego, if you look at Alina North Park and you see the house is 800 square feet, but the lot is 15,000 square feet.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, if you're just looking at the house, like you're going to lose. You have to look at the lot and see what could you actually build on that. It's a knockdown. Yeah, exactly. Build ADUs on it. There's a whole thing. So that's a lot of those high-end markets. And I actually, a quick example, and then I promise we'll move on. I got a lead years ago. It was an infill lot in Westchester County, New York, which is right near the city. And the guy was asking market value for the land. Paid in market value and still made $50,000 wholesaling it because we knew that completed is $3.5 million. Mm-hmm. The cost to get the dirt was $650 or whatever. And that guy still had enough meat on the bone to make some money on the back end. So if you don't know the market, like in a situation like that, you're going to look at it, oh, he's asking market value. This isn't a deal. So just knowing your market to an intricate level like that allows you to number one, make your marketing more profitable. And number two, really maximize these opportunities because there's only so many of them every day, right?
That's one of the advantages of going deep within a market. Going wide, in my opinion, is if you're really good at specific channels, targeting certain data that is not overly abundant, but then you do that across multiple markets, that's probably a decent strategy for you. But there's a ton of value just knowing street by street almost.
And there's a lot more deals than you think of in a deep market, especially in San Diego. There's so much opportunity in a big city like that versus an area where there's less than 1 million people. Yeah, you can go deep there, but you're going to hit a level at a certain point where you're going to cap out most likely. So let's transition to marketing. So you guys obviously are doing many channels. What are the best, let's say, 2 channels that you guys have seen for GG Homes that have worked effectively, efficiently over time? Because a lot of marketing kind of ebbs and flows, but there's always a few that usually stick around and last the test of time within 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, for us, it's been direct mail and pay-per-click marketing.
Not surprised by that answer. They work so well. I'm the same in my business.
I'll be honest, I think every channel works great. We're on TV as well. We do calling. We've done texting in the past. We do agent relations very well. We actually love that channel. It has the highest return on ad spend. We love that channel. We've presented on it in some of our masterminds several times. We're running YouTube. We even have TikTok ads running right now, believe it or not. We've got some pieces in there, but I'd say those 2 channels are really solid.
Do you find with the television ads and other broad stuff, that's just amplifying your mail and your PPC because people are seeing you like omnipresent? Like I used to go to 24-hour fitness and go on the treadmill in San Diego and I'd see Doug Hopkins on TV filming for you guys.
Yeah, omnichannel is key. It's interesting. I went to a marketing conference earlier this year and there was a marketing agency that did a case study. They took over a personal injury attorney, and the personal injury attorneys are decent comps to look at for marketing because their lifetime value of a customer, although it's in a short window when someone has an accident, Blackstone, it's comparable to flipping houses in a way. What they had talked about, they showed how introducing omnichannel reduced down their cost per leads and brought up the return on ad spend tremendously. And what their study had shown was that by increasing things like Meta, we're not talking conversions, just simply impressions, was increasing their return on ad spend by like massive numbers, 100% increase, 150% increase. And so it was some data showing the power of being omnichannel. And so TV is a great way of doing that. You're on television, people see you, and then they see your search engine optimization. Then they get a piece of mail from you. These things all compound. And when you do become more omnipresent, it gives you huge advantages.
Do you find that harder to track though on a straight direct ROI? Oh, yeah. Because if they come from TV, but they really search you on SEO, do you have a way internally to track that? Or do you just look at the blended overall ROAS? That can get crazy. Even with my little business, it can get confusing for me.
I think you can get a little bit more clarity, especially as you spend more, and just all these campaigns that have enough sample size. But what we like to do is, obviously we have all our tracking set up in our backend. We built a custom sales force in the backend, so we can see all the UTM. Yeah. We can see where people came from in advance. We can see a lot of that, and it rolls up into the correct lead source a lot of the time. We also have a drop-down filter in our website after they've already submitted information saying, how'd you hear about us? Then as another check and balance, our closing managers also then ask them saying, hey, by the way, just want to confirm you had first seen us on radio, heard us on radio, or you've seen us on TV. How did you come about finding out about our business? And then we'll use that attribution. But even then, we're not 100%.
We got a deal a couple weeks ago and I asked the seller, how'd you find us? And then I looked at the database and he was in the mailing list. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense. I always tell people with mailers, it's like the best of both worlds. It is an inbound channel, in my opinion, because they're choosing to call you despite half of them wanting to get removed from the list, which it is what it is. The balance of those sellers who are not getting removed from the list, not only are they pretty motivated because they're calling a direct mail piece with a generally a low response rate, but you can target where you want to mail to versus with an internet lead. You don't know. They could have no equity. It could be a short sale. It could be listed. So I've always found with mail, it is much more of a consistent, steady eddy channel because you could target. And if you remove the people who want to get removed, you're mailing the right list. So that's why I've always never been skittish to spend money in mail because I always know that return's coming back. It might not be right away, but I have the data from 5+ years. This makes the most sense for our company.
And our findings is we're seeing like 70% of our deals come in the first month from mail. It's very predictable. You're also able to target who you want to send to. And so depending on how you aggregate your data sources, we feel very confident about ours. And also what's nice about mail, maybe you're not as great at sales. Mail could be a good channel for you because sometimes you're the only sales copy that they've seen. You might be the only call that they make. Whereas PPC, if you don't have a high spend on PPC, guess what? You're probably the third call.
And then if you mail them over and over again, like you're the only game in town when they're ready to sell. And then that's where you can really maximize that opportunity. So I agree with you. I think mail is phenomenal for consistency. So as we wind the show down, Eric, I want to respect your time, keep this under an hour. You're the COO of this company. What are some of the critical KPIs you look personally to make sure your business is on track? What are some of these numbers you're looking at from a data standpoint?
Yeah, definitely. Let's do this. Let's break it down by department.
Beautiful. Even better.
I'll start at top of the funnel. For us, we look at brand imaging at top of the funnel. What we're looking at is the number of 5-star reviews that we bring into our business on Google, on BBB. So if you look at us online, we're 4.8 or 4.9 stars. I think we're close to 400 5-star reviews. That's where it starts. So maintaining that brand, making sure that we connect with any sellers. If we do get a bad review, we want to protect that number one. So that's where it starts. Next thing that I'll go down to is recruiting. We have across our 7 companies, I think we have 130 employees. For us, recruiting is centralized though. So it runs recruiting for all those different businesses. And we look at the number of initial calls we make and then the assessments that we send out, basically getting people started in our funnel. So that our top line funnel of candidates comes in, that'll mean great quality input to how many people this week did we talk to brand new that it started our funnel.
That's a good number.
And so that on an average week, that might be 150 people. On marketing, we want to make sure that our marketing budgets are going to generate enough leads on a daily basis. So we're looking at the amount of expected value in sales from a marketing perspective. So for example, if our goal is to sign $1 million this week, we need to make sure that we have probably 200,000 in marketing being sent out.
So like a 5x ROAS forecast.
Exactly. So want to make sure that amount of marketing is dropping. We'll then look at, did that happen? And then does it translate to leads? And then the back end of that is what's our ROAS for each channel? And then you break it down from overarching the direct mail, PPC, TV. You then drop it down to the sub attributions, making sure that those individual campaigns in each of those are working. Then you spend more where it's working. And then you talk with your leadership and then you go figure out and diagnose. On sales, number one, is our answer rate high? Is our speed outreach very high?
Like web form submissions and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, Yeah, we want to be sub 60 seconds every time. And those in general, we under 3 minutes is our answer rate over 95%. And then of those 5%, or maybe it becomes 10% or more that don't get answered, that would be the starting of lead management. Then it looks at lead conversion rate and then looking at cancellation rate of appointments. Why would those go high? Moving into closing, we're looking at our revenue per appointment.
So you break it down. This appointment was worth X amount of dollars in revenue just for this gentleman to show up and make an offer, basically.
Exactly. And we'll kind of group them into categories, but we can tell we have a stag rank of our closers saying, hey, this closer's, they're at 20K per appointment. That's beating the other guy. Also want to make sure their calendars are full. If they're not full, can we make it more full, especially if they're very profitable? It jumps into then asset management, which is evaluating properties. We'll look at accuracy of comps. We'll look at speed to response on our offer amounts. We look at how they project revenue. Then finance and accounting, we're down looking at cash balances and making sure that we're reinvesting correctly. So,
dude, that was like my favorite part of the podcast because you went like above and beyond, so dialed in, which makes sense because you guys are at the level you're at for a reason. It might be the best podcast I've ever done in terms of a real operator sharing real information. As we start to wind the show down, I know you actually have two other additional businesses that you guys have started that are geared towards the investor. So I believe one of them is Google Ads Management and the other one is a direct mail. Would you mind maybe speaking about them for a few minutes, what you guys can offer?
Absolutely. We have a wait list right now for both businesses, but if you're interested, we're happy to get you on. We spend about $450,000 to $500,000 a month in mail. And then we started beta testing. We basically got a lot of people from our mastermind saying, hey, would you run mail for us? We see the results you're getting. Can you do it for us? And so we beta tested with 5 clients. All of them had a minimum 5X return on ad spend. So we've now scaled. I think we have 23 clients across the nation. Every single one of them are performing. This would be a good place for someone who has a monthly budget of at least probably $15,000 a month. If someone had less than that to spend in this one channel, come talk to us. We can give you a roadmap of how to maybe get there and some pointers. I'd be happy to help someone out who's starting off. So just shoot me a message. But especially as you get to scale, you give us our budget, we'll produce leads that are going to convert and we'll make sure we help you optimize. We even help some training on how to do sales intake and stuff like that for our clients. So that's the direct mail side. PPC side, Google Ad Management, we're on PPC Force. And on the PPC side, some larger organization, I think there's over 100 clients across the nation. And it's a really great lead source as well.
Eric, if people want to follow you, connect with you, what's the best way for them to get into your world from a contact standpoint?
Yeah, I'd say on Instagram is great or Facebook. So it's Eric Gydesen, E-R-I-C-K-G-Y-D-E-S-E-N. Just follow me there. You can also shoot me an email. I'll give you the easy one. Just my first name, last name at Gmail. Shoot me an email.
There's his personal email account right to the source. Listen, Eric, this was probably the best podcast I've done in the last 3 years from a high level and then a tactical standpoint. This is going to do phenomenally well. I really appreciate you coming on, man. Thank you so much for being a guest. And I'm looking forward to putting this out into the world.
Greg, yeah, thanks so much for having me. You're a fantastic interviewer. I'm excited to hopefully create some value for your audience and help everything grow on that end.